Sorry about that noise, guys. I just slapped Tyson Fury in the face. You'd think the world heavyweight champion wouldn't cry so much just because I took his lunch money. I'm just glad my students aren't here to see how I humiliated him. Okay, so, last class I told you I would get into the Industrial Revolution. Massively, massively important event in human history. Not only because, as I said, it will give birth to communism, but also because it shaped the entire world around us and continues to do so. Now, why don't we start with a test term, Industrial Revolution, and that should be capitalized. Industrial Revolution. For that, you need to write an event in which the work done in the world, an event in which the work done in the world began to shift from human and animal labor to machine labor, period. So test term is Industrial Revolution, and for that you need to write an event in which the work done in the world began to shift from human and animal labor to machine labor, period. See, the machine age is only about 250 years old. Before that, you could count the total number of machines on one hand. People depended on human power or animal power. That's what it was. But someone discovered how to make machines that could do the job as well or better than humans. And what are the benefits of machines over humans? You can think of them yourself. They can produce much faster than humans. They can go nonstop 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They don't complain. They don't sleep. They don't eat. They don't protest. They don't go on strike. They don't get sick. And as I said, they produce far, far more than humans. Now, write this down. It's the second test term. The Industrial Revolution began around the Industrial Revolution began around 1750 in England, England, in England, period. The test term is England, and it is still going on today. It's one of the most transformative events in human history, but it is still ongoing. Every time something new is invented, cell phones, laptops, hybrid cars, some of you may be driving. What about different technologies? Bluetooth. Okay, I know a number of you probably have Bluetooth. Why is it called Bluetooth? What's going on there? Because the guy who invented it never brushed his teeth. No, that's a joke. The name was given, you see, taking a step back here, a lot of cell phone stuff comes out of the Scandinavian area. Even in that first Transformers movie, there's some talk about that. Ah, Nokia, they know the way of the samurai. And the woman says, isn't Nokia Finnish? Well, in fact, yes, it is Finland and Nokia with the Nokia River and the town of Nokia, which was named after it. And yeah, that's the cell phone stuff. But a lot of it comes from that. And this technology is no different. Bluetooth, what does it do? It connects different devices wirelessly. That's what Bluetooth technology is. And Scandinavian, these people from Ericsson, the company Ericsson, they named this technology Bluetooth in honor of this 10th century Viking king. His name was Harald Bluetooth. His name in Scandinavian is something different, Blatand or something like that, but his name translates to Harald Bluetooth. And the reason they called him that is actually nothing to do with his teeth, but there in the Scandinavian area in the far north, they get far less sun. So not only are they white, but they are really, really white. If their hair is not just blonde, it's pretty much white. The people there almost look like albinos if you look at the extreme. I've had Scandinavian students and everything like that. And of course, they need to absorb as much vitamin D as possible. So they have very little pigment or no pigment in their skin and hair and things like that. But this guy, he had not only black hair, his hair was so black it was almost blue. So that's why he got this name, Bluetooth. That's why he got that nickname, sort of. And he was a Viking king who unified Denmark and Norway, these two separate kingdoms. So these people at Ericsson, these engineers, named this technology that unifies different devices together, Bluetooth. And if you look at the Bluetooth symbol, maybe you've even got it on your keyboard or something like that, it's runic letters, meaning the Viking way of writing, very primitive, but it's there. It's the H from Harald and the B from Bluetooth put together. That's the Bluetooth symbol. Anyway, it's everything. I mean, anytime something is invented, and technology, by the way, just keeps getting more and more advanced, but it keeps doing so faster and faster and faster. That's another theme in history, that change keeps getting faster as time goes on. You know, the difference between the year 1100 and the year 1200 was very slight. The difference between the year 1900 and the year 2000 was pretty gigantic. And the difference between the year 2000 and 2100, I'm sure, will be gigantic as well, even more so. You see how fast technology is improving and changing, almost incomprehensible. I mean, there's this way of looking at, interesting way of looking at things. In 1969, aliens invaded the moon. Aliens invaded the moon. What am I talking about? What on earth am I talking about? Well, what happened in 1969? In 1969, Buzz Aldrin and his flight commander Neil Armstrong made the Apollo 11 flight to the moon. They became the first two humans to set foot on an alien world. Now, why did I say that earlier? It's because actually it's not so much an alien world. We are not from there, so we are the aliens invading the moon. And this is just a little side note to show you about perspective and things like this anecdote about this American woman who went to Britain, and she said to someone there, "Oh, I really love your accent." And the British woman said, "Oh, I don't have an accent. You do." Anyway, there's more I'd like to get into with this stuff. But anyway, now why do I bring this up at all? Moon landing. Well, the Wright brothers in 1903, the Wright brothers took the first powered flight in human history. 1903. So basically all of human history it took for humankind to develop powered flight. And that flight, by the way, was about 12 seconds and a little over 100 feet they flew in the air. 1903. 66 years later, humankind walked on the moon. And Neil Armstrong was the first man to actually set foot on the moon. And as he took his first step, he said this incredibly famous line, "One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." And it was true. You're talking about people, a lot of people had been born into a world where not a single human being had ever flown in the air with powered flight. We're not talking about hot air balloons and stuff like that, or falling off a cliff. So born into a world where no human being had ever flown and lived to see human beings walking on the moon. Technology is just moving forward at light speed. You see, and it keeps moving forward faster and faster and faster. The cell phones you have in your pocket, the weakest one of your cell phones, is much more powerful than all the computer power all of NASA had when it sent those people to the moon. Massively, massively more powerful than all the computing power of NASA when it sent people to the moon. There's this author and scientist, Michiko Kaku. I may be mispronouncing his first name, but his last name is Kaku. And he's done a lot of stuff. I've seen him on TV and everything like that. And one of his books, he writes that this example that if you receive a birthday card in the mail that has that thing which sings happy birthday to you, that chip in it has more computing power than all the Allied forces of 1945. Than all that's how much more powerful just that chip and the birthday card is. And what do? After the birthday, we throw the card and the chip away. That's how little that technology means to us today, but how much it used to mean back in the day. And there's this idea, some of you may have heard, I know there's at least a couple of computer science people in the class. You may have heard of Moore's Law, M-O-O-R-E, Moore's Law. And that's this guy, Gordon Moore, from Intel. Now, this guy, Gordon Moore, he co-founded Intel, and he didn't give it the name Moore's Law. In fact, he didn't even say this, but he said that the number of transistors packed onto a circuit would double every year. And then a few years later, he saw new data, and then he changed it to doubling every 2 years, they would double. But basically, for various reasons, this has come true, and that's pretty close to computing power. And so basically, simply put, every year or every 18 months is how it worked out. So an average between his two predictions, computing power has doubled. This has been true for decades and decades and decades. He made this prediction way, way back, more than 50 years ago, basically. At least since 1975. And it's been true. About every 18 months, computing power has doubled. Now, this is not an accident. Another thing we learned from history is things happen for a reason. Very powerful reason, even if we don't see them immediately. So this was not so much only a prediction. The computer industry and everything related to it kind of used it as a guideline, and they needed one because computers and whatnot use so much machinery and software and raw materials from so many different places and so many different companies and different countries and whatever it is. So they need something to keep themselves coordinated, some kind of guideline, some sort of timeline to work off of so that they're all in sync. But here, you look at this, for about 50 years, computing power has doubled every year and a half. And it's just been absolutely incredible. Back in the mid-90s, IBM, which was the ultimate computer company back then, the ultimate computer company, they designed a giant computer, it was called Deep Blue, just to play and try and beat the best human chess player. Now, it couldn't, it lost. It won one or two of the games, but in the whole match, it lost. They heavily upgraded it, and the next year, it just barely beat the best human chess player on earth, Garry Kasparov. And they don't even have those contests anymore. But by the way, Kasparov said in the interviews, he couldn't believe it. The computer made a move that was only capable, that only a human being could possibly make. He could not believe it. He even thought maybe they cheated. But ultimately, the computer was playing like a human. And now, they long ago stopped having those contests because it would be no contest. Apparently, even the computer games you can buy at Best Buy, those chess games can beat the chess grandmasters. So here, computers are just getting stronger and smarter and more capable. And you see how many jobs have gone away because of robots and because of computers and things like that. And computers and machines can just do them so much better than humans. It has been predicted by futurists. There are actually people called futurists who study the future and everything. One famous person from Harvard, Ray Kurzweil, very famous, has said that by the year 2045, computers will be able to do every single thing better than a human can. There will be nothing that a human can do that a computer can't do much better. Much better. Computers will be able to compose music better, appreciate music better, love better. They can do everything better than humans. And the only way humans will be able to keep up rather than becoming obsolete is how? To merge with the machines and use them to enhance ourselves. Now, this is already been going on in our own lives. I mean, we've started using computers and desktops and laptops, which we could carry with us, and then our phones. I mean, anytime we need to know something, or you guys just pull out your phone, you Google it, you search it right there. So the machines are becoming more and more a part of us. And moving forward, I mean, there's this Google Glass. Google Glass never really took off, but those glasses which you have Google integrated into it and integrated into everything you see, things like that. How long until, what is the next logical step? Implant something directly into our brains, so anytime we need to know something, we just think it and we download it right there. A little bit like the Matrix, where a guy needs to learn how to ride a motorcycle. He just downloads the information immediately. He can ride a motorcycle. And actually, we've had this, let's call them cyborgs, mixing of man and machine, for a long time now. You have hearing aids and pacemakers and titanium hip replacements, that kind of thing. You see, even interestingly, during the Gulf War, which, well, I guess we're still in it, the Iraq War, the vice president at the time, Dick Cheney, they actually had to take his pacemaker offline so it couldn't be used with Wi-Fi or anything because they were concerned the enemy might hack in and cause his pacemaker to give him a heart attack and assassinate the vice president that way. But we've had these types of things. And even beyond that, even before that, you can look at wooden legs and false teeth, different things like that, arguably glasses, that sort of thing. So we've been using these artificial things to enhance ourselves. How long until we take it to the next logical step? Because after all, if we don't do that, we'll be obsolete. We won't be able to keep up. You see, biological enhancements. You know, maybe it's not machines, but we enhance ourselves in different ways. You know about steroids and different things like that. More recently, Adderall to boost, kind of like mental steroids. But genetic modification. You see, they've extracted DNA from woolly mammoth bones, trying to edit those genes into elephants to bring back the woolly mammoth from extinction. You see, organs being artificially grown and things like that. You see if we can edit our genetic code to change it differently, this is what people are working on. I mean, you see this coronavirus and all that kind of stuff. People are thinking, no, forget about the viruses themselves. If we change our DNA, edit it, not radically, but just change it, it would make us immune to every disease and virus in existence. And they would all die out, because once people can't get it, they're just, the viruses will just die out. It would be, I think it's similar to like why Windows viruses don't work against a Macintosh computer. It doesn't recognize it, and it can't have any effect. And unlike a computer virus, these physical viruses would just die out because they have no hosts to carry them, so it would be the end of disease, period. Even the common cold, anything, gone. Now, we're already genetically modifying food and things like that. I mean, we've always done it throughout human history. I mean, corn used to be the size of a dime or a quarter, some really, really small thing, and in the Middle Ages it had like doubled in size, and since then it's become fair what you think of an ear of corn right now. But and by the way, this is over 10 years ago. I saw that they were trying to make corn glow in the dark. Maybe they succeeded, you know, in Iowa and places like that. You see these huge, huge areas with very few people. And there was always this problem with, it's dark, they're not going to light all this area with electricity. It's way too expensive to put that in. So if they, and people would accidentally drive their cars into these cornfields, ruin the car, you know, it has to be towed out, all this kind of stuff. So they wanted to make the corn glow in the dark so people wouldn't drive into it. And you see, it's becoming that commonplace to manipulate DNA, not just in food, but even really, I mean, has anyone here heard of the spider goat? Anyone at home, have you heard of the spider goat? What is that thing? Well, if you see spider silk, like you can think of Spider-Man or whatever it is, spider silk is really, really, really strong. Pound for pound, it's actually stronger than steel. But you need millions of spiders to create enough silk to be useful. I mean, you can't even farm it like silk worms. You can, silk is kind of expensive, but silk worms, you can farm them. Spiders are very territorial and they're cannibalistic, and they'll eat each other. So it's very, very difficult. And actually, there is one piece of cloth. It's like a blanket or something like that. At least a few years back, it was in the New York City Museum. And it was this golden cloth where I remember they spent 4 years collecting these golden spiders from like telephone poles and everything like that, and at least a dozen workers were carefully taking all that silk and everything like that, and they made this big piece of cloth from spider silk, and it looks quite beautiful. I saw a PBS documentary on it years ago, and in fact that's fine, but how are you going to make anything really, when it takes 4 years to make that one cloth, how are you going to make anything for the masses? Well, they cloned a goat with 4% spider DNA, and they tried to take, and they wanted to take from the goat's milk the spider silk enzyme and make cloth out of that. So the spider goat, basically. Now, it didn't fully work, that's what it was, but they basically got well into it. And what they were actually trying to do, when you can get the spider silk kind of stuff, is, for example, just for one example, you can make a bulletproof vests for the police and the military. Can make bulletproof vests. Now, and of course that would be useful in day-to-day life. You see, I remember when there were all these shootings in the schools, elementary schools and everything, they came out with bulletproof backpacks and everything. Spider silk would be much better than Kevlar. That's what it is. You can use it because it's an organic type of thing, spider webbing, basically. You can make sutures out of it. You can make stitches out of it. You can make skin grafts, basically, or something close to it for burn victims. Give ourselves an extra layer of protection. And while we're on the subject, you know, why not, you know, why are we upgrading genetically modifying animals and things like that to create this bulletproof material for us? How long until we just upgrade ourselves, genetically modify ourselves so that our children are born with skin that is bulletproof? And what other upgrades can we get? You see 20/20 vision, right? What is 20/20 vision? Most people think, oh, 20/20 vision means it's perfect. No, it is not. 20/20 vision is average vision. The first number is how far we're away from the eye chart, and the second number is how far away the average person sees what we see. In other words, we're going to be 20 feet from that eye chart when we take an eye exam. Now, interestingly, most doctors' offices don't have that 20-foot length. They simulate it using mirrors and other stuff. But anyway, so when we're 20 feet away, we see something, and then the second number is how far away the average person has to be to see that. So if our vision is 20/40, we're seeing at 20 feet away what the average person can see from twice that distance. From 40 feet away, they can see it. Now, there's actually better than 20/20 vision. Some people have 20/15 vision. Some people have even 20/10 vision. That is what an average person sees from 10 feet away. They can see when they're 20 feet away. So it's pretty impressive. But when you see a hawk is a predatory bird that needs really keen eyesight. It has, to my, off the top of my head, it has the best vision of any animal. Visual acuity, I mean. How sharp, how clear it's seen. Of any creature. And a hawk can have up to 20/2 vision. That means what a hawk can see at 20 feet away, a human has to be 2 feet away to see that. So impressive, impressive vision. Wouldn't we want to maybe genetically engineer our kids to have really good vision with a maybe 1 or 2% hawk DNA? What about a dog's hearing? Wouldn't we like to amplify our hearing and be really good? And why stop there? Why are we just enhancing our human abilities? Why not get even non-human abilities? Speaking of vision, I mean, snakes see in infrared. Deer see in ultraviolet. When you see it's not only the visual acuity, it's, for example, an eagle has very good vision, and a lot of birds have very good vision, predatory birds, I mean. But it's also their placement. When you see eagles, because of how their eyes are placed, and especially this other bird called a woodcock, because their eyes are placed in a certain way, like almost to the sides of their bodies, they're able to see 360 degrees around them. How long until people decide to do that? How long until they people say, you know what, why should I just stop when my kid has hawk vision? Why don't I give my kid hawk wings? Well, I would like my kid to be able to fly. I bet you there's going to be people who want to do that. And you know there are people who are going to want to do that. What about how long we live? What about that? You know, for most of human history, until around the Middle Ages, the human lifespan was about 30 years. That was the average lifespan. Now, mind you, a lot of people misunderstand this. This is an average, and it gets pulled down a lot because of infant deaths and women who die during childbirth, but especially when you've got a lot of people dying when they're born, you know, at zero, that pulls the average down. But still, 30 years up to the Middle Ages. Then over the next 400 years or so, or 300 years or so, it reached up to 40. Average lifespan got up to 40. Then in the 2000s, right around our time, in the Western world, the life expectancy is almost 80 years old, 80. It's 79, I believe. I haven't checked it recently, but it's about 80 years old. So for most of human history, it was 30. Then in the next few hundred years, it went up to 40. Then in less than 200 years later, it doubled to 80. Now again, a lot of that is due to the infant deaths and things like that being taken out of it and childhood disease, but still, we are really developing a lot of things that will make us live a lot longer. I don't know if anyone, probably some of you have heard of progeria. It's P-R-O-G-E-R-I-A. I remember how to spell it because it's from the Greek, like so much. Everything is Greek or Latin, Latin or Greek, and especially in medicine. So Greek pro means before, and then geros or geros means old age. So progeria, it's when these little kids age extremely rapidly, like 8 times the speed that they normally should. And you have 5-year-olds who look like 40-year-olds or 40 or 50-year-olds like that. And they die very young. The oldest they'll ever possibly get, and that's really old for them, is 20. But usually they die around like 13 or 14 years old. They age really, really rapidly. And it's a rare genetic disorder, so that's a good thing at least. But scientists have been studying them for, among other reasons, to find out what is different about them, because that must be what causes aging. We'd love to find out what causes aging. And once we find out what it is that causes aging, we can start trying to turn it off. And there are many people who are predicting that within our lifespan, they will be able to do that. They will be able to turn off the thing that makes us age, and our average lifespan will go up to 120. The average lifespan will be 120, and more importantly, because we're turning off aging, we will live till 120, not hooked up to some respirator, unable to get out of bed and everything like that, but we'll live with the bodies of, let's say, 50-year-olds when we're dying. By the time we die, we'll still have the body of, let's say, a 50-year-old rather than a 120-year-old. So we'll be able to enjoy our lives fully, functionally, everything like that, and then we'll just shut down because, of course, they're not curing death itself. But frankly, it's a new field, gerontology, the study of aging, and they're making big developments. And just so you understand, maybe death itself. There are people who believe that death is not and should not be inevitable. We thought a lot of things throughout history, we've thought a lot of things were inevitable until we found out, you know what? They're not. They are not inevitable. What happened was we figured out different ways to do things, to change things. And some people say that death is merely one more illness that needs to be cured. And in fact, we've had, for all of human history, there has been immortality on the earth in different things. Trees, there are trees that are 10,000 years old. And in terms of creatures, there are animals that are immortal. You see, I was going to give the example of like jellyfish. Jellyfish, you know, may be immortal. You see a jellyfish, it may be thousands of years old. Sea turtles, you know, lobsters, you see these types of things. And when you see, even in humans, it's surprising, they had discovered immortality of a sort. This was many decades ago. They said, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. We've discovered these cells that don't die. They just keep replicating, everything like that. But then they found out, tragically, no, this is cancer. They discovered cancer, which is the cells just keep replicating and don't die and everything like that. But still, it is a type of immortality, one that kills you in a terrible fashion, but human beings are capable of it. We see that. And just like healing and everything like that, to take a step back here, when you look at genetic modifications, what about a starfish? You know, you cut a starfish in half, does it die? No, it just heals itself. And you see these in movies and everything like that, where, some sci-fi movie where a guy loses his arm, it grows right back. But a lot of things were science fiction until we actually figured out how to do it. And then it wasn't science fiction anymore. It was science reality. They're working on reversing the aging process. Not exactly editing the genes, although they're doing that too, but this would be more so adding genes. That a gene function breaks down, and so they boost it back up by adding extra copies of the genes we already have. They've done it in mice, and it actually worked. Now they're trying it in dogs. This Harvard scientist, after that, you know, they'll try it some more, and then another 10 years for human trials, and then it would be ready for the public if it works. But as I say, it's already worked in mice, and you know, we've always found some way to fix these problems that we have. And this adding of genes actually would reverse the aging process, not just freeze it or slow it. It would actually reverse the aging process. And we have different ideas out there. Even if, see, this is why this key thing about extending our lives to the age of 120, if that comes true, and a lot of people say it will, these futurists and everything, in our lives, if you take this premise that, in fact, technology keeps improving faster and faster and faster, those extra decades it gives us will be incredible technological developments, incredible technological developments. What will we be able to do? What will we develop in that time? Cloning, perhaps, full cloning of our human bodies. And then we not only use the clone for spare parts every time we need something, a lung or a kidney or a heart or anything like that, eyes, whatever. And that's another idea with this 3D printers. You know, used to be science fiction, but now it's becoming a reality. It is a reality, frankly, but can we not 3D print organs? Can we not 3D print new bodies for ourselves and then perhaps download our consciousness into these new bodies? You may wonder, well, where are we going to live if human beings actually live so much longer? And, you know, the planet already has so many billions of people on it. Won't there be overpopulation? Won't there be all these problems? Well, the thing is, with this new technology, we get new developments. It's always been this issue of overpopulation. The Earth has always been, people have always been worried about it and concerned about it and these resources and whatnot. Well, part of it is that we create new things, as I say, as I keep saying, necessity is the mother of invention. It happened with the Greeks. It happened with the Phoenicians. They had to come up with something, and that's when they did. And it happens all the time with humanity. I'm a history professor. I can tell you, over and over again, we come up with some new way, only because we have to solve a crisis, to solve a problem. And you see scarcity. Well, how will we have enough food? How will we have this and that? Well, you know, what about this 3D printing, which I just mentioned, getting more and more advanced and being like Star Trek, the replicators? You want something, you just order it. You want a hot fudge sundae, you just do that, and the 3D printer creates it, rearranges it. Anything you want. You want a jet airplane, it just makes it for you right there. Anything you need. It would be the end of scarcity. There would be no need for, and we're already talking about guaranteed income. What is that? What is that? Even Andrew Yang, one of the Democratic candidates who was running for president, he's dropped out now. He was talking about a guaranteed income, that now with technology and everything like that, it's just removing so much work for human beings. eventually we'll be getting to a point where there's no more work for us to do. And by the way, it's been said, maybe unemployment isn't a problem, it's a solution. But here, you know, what are we going to do for a living? How are we going to make money? Well, the solution would be, many would argue, as has been done in other countries, some Scandinavian countries and everything, everybody gets money from the government, no matter what, whether they work, don't work, anything like that, and they can do whatever they want with it. So, these different issues, you know, what will it mean if human beings no longer need to work? What will it mean if there's no more scarcity, that we can have anything we want? You want gold, it'll make gold. You want platinum, you want diamonds, you want whatever it is, it will just make it right there. And that's not too far from what's happening right now, just so you understand. All of these things I'm talking about, it's in your lifetime that I'm talking about them. In fact, some of them are going on right now as we speak. We see, where are we going to live? You know, the earth, you can't make more earth. Well, kind of, you can. I've been to Dubai a couple of times on vacation. And, you know, I've been to their Palm Islands and whatnot, which are artificially created islands. They made them in the shape of a palm tree. Literally, you look on a map, you look on Google Maps or whatever it is, you'll see an island that looks like a palm tree. Clearly, it was man-made. You see all kinds of things. What about creating cities on the ocean, floating cities? What about under the ocean? The ocean, it's water, it contains oxygen. You can take oxygen out of that. You have, and obviously with genetic engineering, I mean, we can give ourselves gills and everything, but what I was referring to is like some sort of dome, some sort of sealed environment under the ocean. 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered in water. So that would be a lot more space, and certainly there are other planets as well. Many of these billionaires are looking toward actually going to Mars and things like that. But even above and beyond that, we talked about downloading our consciousness into a clone of ourselves, or maybe a robot. But what about downloading our consciousness into a completely virtual world? Among the other technological improvements, you know, one of the most obvious is memory. When you sign up for a Gmail account, you get all this memory. That would have been unthinkable when I was in college. That much memory, let alone getting it for free and everybody gets it. Incredible. But that's what it is. And if this keeps up more and more and more, we'll have so much space, so much memory. And by the way, for you computer people who are in the class, I know a lot about Moore's Law and everything like that, and I understand with the problems with heat and everything, and people are saying it's slowing down and this and that, but of course, even though, firstly, he said that he was only talking about how many transistors can be put together by scaling and by shrinking them down and everything like that, there are other ways in which computing power can keep doubling and whatnot, and that has happened over the last 5 years or so. They've been using other techniques now that they can't keep shrinking the transistors down. So even if they don't find a new way to shrink those transistors, there's other things like quantum computing and stuff like that. I'm not a computer guy, but I know, I mean, certainly I hope you guys are also as fascinated by this stuff as I am with the possibilities for us. It's fascinating in the abstract, but it's really fascinating since this is our lifetime right now. This is not some concept. This is real. And this idea here about with memory expanding and expanding, how long until we can just download our consciousness into computers and live in this completely artificial environment forever? If your lifespan, you know, already you see how fast technology has improved. Many of you are about 20 years old. That gives you at least, let's say, 60 years left. What are we going to develop just in that 60 years? And what about if you extend your lifespans even further? What on earth would we develop? And here, this downloading of consciousness into a perfect simulation where you never feel pain or hurt, that you can have anything you want, anytime you want, forever. Different kinds of, or maybe, probably it wouldn't be like that, because it would probably not give life, life wouldn't have meaning that way, it's been said. Most people would probably want some sort of real life, some sort of realistic experience living in the simulated world. And here's another question. How do you know that that hasn't already happened? I would ask you, how do you know that we're not living in a simulation right now? There are many people who believe, there are a good number of people who believe that, yes, we are living in a simulation right now. I think Elon Musk of Tesla believes that we're living in a simulation. And a number of other prominent people do as well. In other words, how do we know? If we see now, this has been questions in philosophy. As I say, history will give you all the answers. This famous French philosopher, René Descartes, some of you may have heard of him, or his famous statement, "I think, therefore I am." Descartes, his name is spelled Descartes, I'm pretty sure. And his first name, René, R-E-N-E. So he's a French philosopher, and he started thinking and wondering, well, you know, how do I know that, now this is hundreds of years ago, so there were no computers or anything, but he's wondering, how do I know for sure that what I see or hear or taste is real? He took a candle and he held it and it's solid. Then he took it near the fire and it became liquid. He said, you know, how do I know that there's not a demon making me believe these things? How do I know that there's not a demon making me think that there's a chair I'm sitting in now or a floor I'm standing on? And he started eliminating anything that could be created by a demon. Or anything that he couldn't be sure existed, until finally there was only one thing he knew for sure. I think, therefore I am. Even if there's a demon tricking him into thinking something, he is still thinking. So the only thing he could be sure of is that he is in fact thinking, and therefore that he exists. Now, we are not hundreds of years ago, and we see modern technology and everything like that. And when I was younger, there were these Sim City games. I never played them, but I know what it is. It's like a simulated life, or some online thing, or whatever it is. And how do you know? You know, forget about your consciousness being downloaded into the thing. You know, in a day-to-day way to look at it. How do you know that your alarm clock didn't go off? And you're not awake right now listening to this lecture, but in fact you're still asleep, dreaming about this lecture. Professor Martins, if we were dreaming, you'd be lecturing with your shirt off. I'm sure all of you are thinking the same thing and saying the same thing, but unfortunately I'm not there to hear it. But I assume that's what you're all thinking. Now, here's something even more trippy. How do you know that you're not in a dream, but it's not even your dream, it's someone else's dream? Someone else in that room with you, or whatever it is asleep dreaming all of this, and as soon as he or she wakes up in 20 minutes, all you are and all you've ever known will just go away permanently. Back to the simulation example. You know, I was going to talk about these video games. That how do you know this isn't the year 2020? Maybe it's the year 3020. It's 1,000 years later. And some kid at home just gotten home from school and he turned on his video game. And all of this, because computers are so much more advanced 1,000 years from now. Frankly, it might be 50 years from now. But anyway, that as soon as he turned on the game, it's created this huge simulated environment. Okay, and you are nothing more than a character in that game. Maybe the person is playing you, or maybe something else, and you're just an accessory there. And when you create a fake character, let's say a robot, an android, or something like that. You give it a backstory so that it behaves in a real way. Actors and actresses, when they play a role, they give their character a backstory. Oh, I went to school here, I had this childhood experience, just to make the character more realistic. How do you know that you really haven't existed only, maybe you've existed only 5 minutes. That kid turned on the game 5 minutes ago. And all this backstory was created for you and everything like that. And an hour, when he gets done, he'll turn it off, and you and everything you know, your whole world will just cease, our whole world will just cease to exist. Maybe I don't exist. Maybe when you create these computer games, it only renders what's around you. So if you're in a room, and I don't know, I don't really play these computer games, but if you're there going through a castle or whatever it is, you know, playing your Call of Duty or whatever, it's only, even though it's supposed to be a whole world, it's only really rendering that room you're in or that house you're in or whatever it is. So how do you know, you who is listening to this right now, that none of your classmates exist, I don't exist, nothing, none of this exists. It's only you, the room you're in, and everything around you. That's what it is. There is no China. There is no Russia. There's no nothing. There's no North Florida. There's no Key Largo or whatever it is. There's only the immediate area around you. And even that will disappear once that kid stops playing the game. So, but here we have this issue of being, you know, again, downloading our consciousness into some virtual world, put the game idea aside. And there's another point most of you have probably not thought of, but there's a movement out there, and there's been this idea for a long time that actually, because this is kind of advanced technology. I mean, this life extension to 120, they're talking about in your lifetime. But, you know, this downloading consciousness and everything, that's a more advanced thing. Especially other things I haven't mentioned, like nanotechnology. As impressive as that would be, you know, you're skateboarding, you break your arm, forget about going to a doctor, it just immediately heals you. When you're born, you get an injection of these nanotechs, and as expensive as they would be to make, you could still make them make more of themselves, obviously, and that's another way in which we could colonize other planets. We make a bunch of these nanotechs, shoot them off to Mars or Venus or whatever, and tell them to make more of themselves, on and on and on, and then terraform the entire planet into another Earth. Change the entire planet into another Earth. But nanotechnology, that's probably much further off. There are people who say, you know, computers, if not in our lifetime, then eventually will become super sophisticated and able to do, you know, enormous amounts of memory and everything like that. They will be able to recreate people from the past, based extrapolating from all details known about the time period, about details of us, your college transcripts, your grades from school, your texts, your tweets, everything like that, will be able, with statistics and computational ability, to recreate everyone who has ever lived on the Earth in all of history, exactly as we are, or roughly as we are right now, and have us living in an artificial world. So extrapolate how we actually were, even though this might be 500 years in the future, that computer will be able to figure out how we were, how we thought, how we spoke, everything, and recreate all of us, even though we had died centuries ago. And we would be there living in a computer. It's food for thought. There's even a Terrasim movement, a religious movement, that really argues that. That really believes that. So, let us get back to the origins of this Industrial Revolution. And by the way, another thing we learn from history is things can get broken up in different ways. There are people, through most of history, we've seen it as the Industrial Revolution. But recently, people have started breaking it up into different Industrial Revolutions, separate ones. and that we're in the third or fourth or fifth or even sixth industrial revolution. Many people, usually people say we're in the fourth industrial revolution, but through most of history we've only seen it as one, and one that keeps continuing. And frankly, the lessons from that are very valuable, as are the lessons from all of history. But it's also a little discouraging. You know, oftentimes we've been on the brink of paradise, that we've had the means, you know, after World War II and different things like that, to make the earth a paradise like never before seen. But inevitably, that new technology or whatever it is seems to be used for extremely destructive purposes. World War I immediately jumps to mind, and we'll talk about that. But I'm really concerned about with these 3D printers. I mean, you see these people who go crazy, mass shooters and spree killers and everything like that. When they can print up a nuclear bomb or even something on a lesser level, I'm really concerned about what they're going to do with that. But anyway, going back here, you know, and you'll see this here with the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. After I get into how this started, you'll see how badly it goes. But, okay, so we're talking about the 1700s in England. As I said, England dominates, when I was explaining John Locke, I explained how England dominates the entire planet. And so anything that happens there affects everyone else, everyone and everything else. Here, England is so powerful, especially because of its navy. It's an island, and so it's navy. Now, in the 1700s, what are ships made from? Well, they're made from wood. And these big ships, which England has, takes a lot of wood. Now, the further north you go, the bigger things are. Polar bears are much bigger than grizzly bears. You know, in the north, I just talked about Scandinavia earlier. Scandinavians, the average height there for males, I believe, is still 6'1". They're tall people. And trees. You know, when you go further north you go, the bigger the trees are. And here, these oak trees in England are huge, huge. But to make one ship of the line, one of England's big ships, takes 5,000 fully grown oak trees. 5,000 of them. Now, as you might imagine, it is a problem. England has lost a lot of its trees, lots of deforestation, and in fact, it becomes illegal to cut down a tree in the king's forest. Illegal. And if you tried to, they would send the shire's reeve. Now, shire is like a S-H-I-R-E. S-H-I-R-E is like a small town in England. And to reeve someone is to punish them in England. So the shire's reeve would be the person who punished you for it, cut your hand off or hanged you or whatever it was. And by the way, from that word, that term, shire's reeve, we get sheriff. That's what it is. There's all these connections here. With the police, I told you, okay, that comes from polis, the Greek city-state. 5-0, the slang term for police. Whereas that, there's always a reason for all these things, and it comes from this old police show, which they remade recently, Hawaii 5-0. Since the show was called Hawaii 5-0, and the show was called that because Hawaii was the 50th state, the last state absorbed into the country. It was Alaska was 49, Hawaii was the 50th state. So that's how the name 5-0 came about, not because of the 5.0 5-liter engines the police used to drive. That's a myth. But anyway, so that's what it, and a side note here, there was one time when you could take, damn. All right, is this thing still on? Okay, so. There was one time when you could take a tree from the king's forest. That's when it was old and rotted out to the point where the wind had knocked it over. So it was so old and worn out that the wind had knocked it. You couldn't push it over. Then everybody would go try and push over trees. But if it had fallen over on its own, then you could take it. And that's where the term windfall comes from. These days, if you say it's a windfall, that's because you won the lottery or something. That's a windfall. Back then it was, oh, you found a tree. The wind made this tree fall over. That was a great thing for them because you need wood. But what is the climate in England? It's cold, damp. How are you going to stay warm? Well, what you need to do is burn something for fire. Well, you could burn wood, but now it's gotten so scarce that it's illegal to cut down a king's tree and any tree in the forest. So what else can you do? And what is better, frankly, than burning wood to stay warm? Coal. Burning coal is better. And England has a lot of coal. We have a lot of coal in America. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal. What Saudi Arabia has in oil, we have in coal. Huge, huge amounts of coal. But unlike us, see, in a lot of the United States, the coal is close to the surface. You can just scrape it up in places like Virginia. You just scrape the ground and you can see coal. But unlike us, England has the coal deep down and they have to dig for it. Now, there's another problem, which England has a bigger problem. They have a relatively high water table, which means that when you dig down deep enough, you hit water. Here in Miami, it's really extreme. And that's why we don't have basements here like they do in New York and all these other places. Because you dig a little bit, you'll hit water. I have tried to cut out a lot of unnecessary tangents, but just if you want an example, across from Dadeland Mall, there's downtown Dadeland. I was there, you know, not there specifically, but I have property next to it. And, you know, so I know about it. And you would see drive by there day after day, month after month, year after year, when they were trying to build that property. Downtown Dadeland was distinct in that they were going to have a two-story underground garage. They thought, oh, we can do it. Well, they couldn't do it. The construction company went bankrupt. Every day you would drive by there, you would see two holes in the ground filled with water. Construction company went bankrupt. I think the one after them might have gone bankrupt too. And finally, they got it built, obviously, but water would still come up into the garage. That's what it is. And that's with modern stuff. How are these people in England going to go down, dig down 100 feet, 150 feet, which is pretty deep, to get coal when there's water there? Now, the mine owners don't really care about the well-being of the workers. They don't. But the workers can't breathe underwater. They physically cannot get the coal. And England needs the coal, and necessity is the mother of invention. And so they come up with a machine. They've had hand-powered water pumps since the times of ancient Rome, maybe even earlier. A human being was pumping the water out. And that's fine, but that doesn't help very much when the water is 100 feet deep. You can't, human beings aren't able to pump out that kind of water. So they created the first mechanical pump. I think it was in 1804. And it wasn't very good, but it was basically much better than a human could do it. Much better. And how was it powered? Well, all the first machines were powered by steam. Almost all. I mean, there's windmills and whatnot powered by wind, but these are basically powered by steam. You heat the water, creates steam, the steam turns something like a crank or whatever it is, and that's what's doing the work. So you have these, and they were crude and inefficient, but they got much better. And actually, I think it was maybe even 1704. I'm not sure when the first water pump. I mean, it's hard to say. But either way, within a few decades, they had, it was probably 1704. And I remember by the 1730s, they had excellent pumps. They had developed excellent water pumps. And Now this gave them ideas. Gave them ideas that this is working so well. And again, I'm going over some of this stuff, which is pretty cool about coal mining and everything like that and the brutality of it. But it gave them ideas about how to use these machines for other things. Other things. You could, actually, maybe I should. No, let's just move on. With England, of course, has this huge, huge empire. And one of the reasons to have an empire, you know, why, when you think about it, why do you want an empire? One big reason for having colonies is the colonies have to buy from you and have to sell from to you. So you have to buy and sell from and to you. And it works out really well for you. That's one of the reasons we Americans broke away from them. We were upset with England charging us more than we would have to pay from other people because we had to buy from them, and buying from us cheaper than what we could sell it to for other people. So basically, we could sell it to others for more money, but England was making us sell it to them. We could buy stuff from other countries cheaper than what England was selling it for, but England made us buy it from them. So money, money, money. But England had all these colonies. England was the United Kingdom, still the United Kingdom, but they had so much. They had Canada, they had Australia, they had so many places here. And they didn't produce much internally, these colonies. Canada, Australia, whatever. So they really need to buy from somebody, you know, and that's going to have to be England. Now, if you see that, then England also had a big foothold in India. India, the crown jewel of the British colonies. And basically, what is the climate like in India? The climate is incredibly hot. It's not only the men in India that are incredibly hot, of which I am a perfect example. It's also the climate. Now, when it's hot, what kind of material do you need to wear? You don't wear wool, that's for when it's cold. You need cotton. Cotton breathes really well. Well, England has also, cotton is really central to a lot of this stuff. And we will come back to this when we talk about America's slave situation. But here, this is how the business model is going to work. You have the raw materials you need for the business, for making clothing. You have transportation is needed. Okay, so raw materials, England has plenty of access to cotton. In the American colonies, from wherever it is, it's got plenty of that. Also needs transportation to transport the raw materials and the finished goods. England is famous for what? Got powerful because of what? Its navy. So it's got really good sea transport all over the world. Then you need to manufacture the raw materials, the cotton, into finished goods. And then finally, you need a market. What did we say? England's got all these colonies. The colonies have to buy from England. So of those four elements, raw materials, check. Transport, check. Manufacturing, not done. That still is a problem. And markets, check. So England has three of those four things to make gigantic amounts of money selling clothing, textiles. Everybody needs clothing. It's a guaranteed market. But the manufacturing is the problem. Throughout history, throughout all of history, these have been handmade. Clothing was handmade. And how do you make clothing? Three steps. Spinning. So you get the raw cotton fibers and you spin it into thread. Weaving. Once you have the thread, you imagine a wooden square opened up so the sides are not touching each other. Or imagine a wooden square. And then you thread it from one end to the other, over and over and over, until you go all the way across the square. Okay? Just threading it from one side to the other, north, south, north, south, north, south, until you fill up that whole square with thread. Then you go east-west within that same square, side to side, side to side, over under the threads you already strung across. So you have this wooden square, and then you thread it north to south all the way across, back and forth, until you've got thread all the way across, north and south, and then you start going east-west. You start going crossways, horizontally. But you don't just go across, you go over and under the threads that you've already stretched north-south. And then you keep going back and forth until you've covered the square again, but this way east-west, and it goes over and under the threads you stretched north-south. When you've completed all of that, you pull the sides of the square apart from each other to pull all those threads tight, and they interlock each other, and that's where you get a bolt of cloth. That's all cloth is. It's thread that's gone north-south a bunch of times, and then east-west, over under the original north-south threads. If you're wearing a t-shirt or something like that, look at it closely and push your thumb through the inside of it and look at it closely. In other words, stretch that cloth out and look at it closely. You'll see that's what the cloth is right now in your t-shirt or whatever it is. So people would do that. It was known as a cottage industry. That's what a cottage industry is. You would, it's today it means something that's just done at home and it's a small scale and everything like that. But originally, you would be there living with your family in a cottage, and all of you would go out with baskets, pick a bunch of cotton, take it back to your cottage, and all these three steps, spinning the raw cotton fiber into thread, weaving the thread into cloth, and the third step is sewing the cloth into whatever it is, a tunic or a skirt or a shirt or whatever it is. So all those three steps would be done by you, and then you'd take it to market. Well, they said, this is a slow process. We've got all these other steps in the business model. We've got the raw materials. We've got the transportation. We've got the markets. The bottleneck is just the manufacturing of these clothing. If we could only make this stuff faster, we've got everything else and we can make gigantic amounts of money. And so these three manufacturing steps, they eventually find a machine that will do each one of them. They create a spinning jenny. And it's large and inefficient, but even the very first ones were 50 times faster than humans. 50 times faster than humans. Spinning, they found 50 times faster than a human. They had a power loom, which would do the weaving. And of course, you know of the sewing machine. So you got all three stages, you got it mechanized, and now you can make clothing really, really fast. The one bottleneck that was slowing everything down in this process now no longer exists. And once you can do this with machines, everybody says, okay, let's get these machines. Produce far, far faster. And these machines are made out of what originally? What are the machines made of? They are not made out of steel, because steel was very expensive back in the day, very hard to make. There was this French king who gave his ladies at court earrings, this is centuries before, steel earrings. No jewels, no nothing, just steel earrings, and they were delighted. Wow, because steel was so expensive and so difficult to use. These machines are made out of iron. And iron has two things wrong with it. One of them is doesn't concern us now, it's that it's brittle. So that's one of the reasons we never had tall, that's the reason why we never had tall buildings until fairly recently. Skyscrapers are a very American invention, and that was because of steel. See, iron was strong enough for us to make tall buildings from. But there's a problem. When you look at tall buildings, what happens in the wind? They move. They sway in the wind. Not that much, but they do. Noticeably, they sway. And the thing is, steel is very flexible, so it will bend. Iron, as strong as it is, it's also brittle. It doesn't have flex to it. And as those tall buildings would sway in the wind, what will happen is the iron girders will crack slightly every time it sways, and eventually it'll crack so bad that the entire building would just fall apart. That's why the buildings didn't get very tall through most of history. So one problem with iron is that it's brittle, but the other problem is that it rusts very quickly, very, very quickly. Therefore, they need a covered structure to put these in, not just a hut or something like that, an actual building to keep all these machines. And this was the factory. This is what became known as a factory, where you keep all these machines in it to produce stuff, to produce goods, textiles, whatever it is you're doing. Now, these primitive machines, especially because they were primitive, they needed to be maintained by human labor. Not just operated by humans, but also maintained. And you had to get in, you had to change the belts, lubricate them, do whatever it is, you know, something breaks, you got to change it, everything like that. And these machines have all these small nooks and crannies, and who is going to fit in there? Children. Children. And that's another thing right there. Maybe I'll make this another... No, I don't think I'll... Yeah, okay, let's make it a test term. Write this down as the third test term. Child labor was part of the factory system. Child labor was part of the factory system from the very beginning, period. And the test term is child labor. Now, it was brutal. It was brutal. By the age of 6, you had these children working 14 hours a day, 12, 14 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. They had no free time, certainly no time for education or anything like that. They earned very low wages. That's part of why they were hired. Women and children were working there because they could be paid less than men. And it was a brutal environment. You had, and not just for the children alone, it was for the men who worked there. Because see, once these machines started producing so cheaply, hey, great. Well, it's the same problem we have now. As I say, history will tell you everything. Now that you got the machines, it took out a lot of jobs. Those people who were making clothing by hand, what are they going to do now? Well, they move to the cities, take jobs in the factories, but the factories are paying much lower because now this is unskilled labor. It's very, very, I mean, it's grueling work. It's hard work. It's brutal work. But you don't need sewing skills or anything like that. It's not like carpentry or whatever, or sewing clothing or spinning cloth. It's basically anyone can do it. And when you have so many people who can do it, now you have so many people, you can pay a lot less. Because if you don't want the job, somebody else will get it. If you don't like the wages, fine, we'll hire somebody else. There's 100 more people outside those factory doors who will take the job if you don't want it. And that's part of why now the whole family had to work. The wife had to work. The children had to work. Everybody's working. And still they're struggling in these brutal conditions. You have also farmers and everyone, basically anyone who couldn't make it. Then they didn't own the farms anyway. So you have all this unskilled labor being paid very little, struggling to survive. And the factory owners don't care. They really don't care. The conditions inside the factories, very dangerous, very hazardous. And what are they making? They're making clothing. If you walk in to one of these factories, you'll see the atmosphere filled with white stuff. What is that? These are the cotton fibers, and they're breathing all that in. They're breathing that in, and what would happen is there was a problem called white lung disease, where you're breathing all these fibers in, and if you know what a paper cut feels like, That's what's happening all the time on the insides of your lungs. These little micro cuts on the insides of your lungs, and it's a brutal, painful way to die. A guaranteed death in a few years. Terrible, terrible situation. And I skipped over the coal mining, but that's another thing. Very, very dangerous work. You know, maybe I should have gone through it. You go down deep into the coal mines. What are the dangers you have there? So many dangers. You have it collapsing on you and killing you. Or what I think is even worse, it burying you alive, sealing you in there, and you can't get out and you die underground because you can't get out. You get these gases underground. That's where we get them from and everything like that. You get poison gases, very poisonous. That's why they would take a canary in with them. And if any of you have heard of the phrase, the canary in the coal mine, that's what it's from. The canary in the coal mine is from, and it's a common phrase. You see, that's another thing. A lot of these phrases that educated people know and should know, they know it for good reason. You would not have heard, but that's why you're here in college. You get exposed to that. And even if you forget it, which I wouldn't blame you, it shouldn't be the first time you're hearing these things when you hear them in society. And you should know these concepts and understand them. It's important for educated people to know this stuff. So what is it? Well, they would take a canary in there. Canaries chirp all the time and everything like that. They also have weak respiratory systems. It's a small bird, basically. And it's there, and the miners are doing their work, and they hear the bird chirping. And when they hear it stop chirping, what happened? They go check, and they'll see the bird has died. Well, that means that there's toxic fumes there, and they need to get out of there. Because the bird has a weaker respiratory system, but it's still going to affect the humans. And that's the meaning of canary in the coal mine. It means something that's indicating a problem, a much bigger problem that's about to come up. They say the bees are dying out all around the world. That's what they say. And that would be an example of the canary in the coal mine. Some bigger problem. If the bees are dying out, that means there's some bigger problem that's going to affect us that we're not seeing yet. It's a leading indicator, let's say. But there's also explosive gases, frankly. Methane, propane, butane, all these different things, they come from underground, literally fossil fuels. And you may wonder, well, why can't you just, you know, smell the propane? If any of you have gas stoves, if any of you have barbecued, something like propane has a very distinct smell. Well, I don't know if any of you know this. Sometimes you do. But propane doesn't have a smell. It is odorless. The reason you can smell it is because by law, it's a very serious law, you must add these chemicals to it that give it a strong smell so that people will know, oh, the gas is leaking or whatever it is. Very dangerous. Let's evacuate, call the fire department. But naturally, propane doesn't have a smell. And see, these things that I bring them up for a reason. I may not have time to go into it, but for me, one of the things this brings up is how much we are kind of looked after in the world we're in right now. In so many ways that we don't even realize, we are not like people through all of history. It's been said that Americans, if we were in any other time period or any other place, we would be dead. Because we don't have the survival skills that those people used to, since so much of our life is kind of safety-proofed for us. We see in the classroom, there was a fire extinguisher, right? When we were in the classroom together. That fire extinguisher is at a certain height. By law, it cannot be lower than a certain height. It cannot be on the ground because it might be exposed to water or it might get knocked around and then it would become ineffective when there's actually a fire. And by the way, they are checked. Those fire extinguishers aren't like, oh, 20 years old and who knows if it'll work or not. They are checked. Where people go around from the county, they see the seal is still on it, everything like that. The extinguishers cannot be higher than a certain height. Why? because somebody in a wheelchair needs to be able to reach it. All these different things in so many different ways. When you see on the road with those lines in the middle of the road, the divider lines and everything like that, they're made with a special kind of paint, because otherwise paint is incredibly slippery. And they put basically like sand or ground glass in it to give it more traction so that it's not so slippery. And, you know, there's a lot of different issues there. Anybody who rides a motorcycle, maybe you've heard that, you know, that's the most dangerous time when you're switching lanes, because when you're going over that paint, even though we've modified it, it's still more slippery and more of a problem. Now, why I brought this up, why this came to mind, is there was another problem: black lung disease. All this coal dust and everything that you're breathing in, black lung disease, that's another painful way to die. Brutal. And you have the, where are all these people going to live? You know, okay, now they've all moved to this factory. Factories are on the rivers because, as I said, the machines are powered by steam. Steam comes from water. So you heat the water up, but where are you going to get the water from? Well, from rivers. So the factories are near the rivers, and that's where towns were anyway. But they were relatively small towns. Now you've got this infusion of people all of a sudden who are moving there to work and everything like that. How are you going to accommodate them? The streets were just scraped up pieces of land that eroded completely when it rained. There's no plumbing facilities. You would just use a bucket. You'd have a bunch of 10 people living in a room, not necessarily related or anything like that. You'd have you'd throw your human waste and excrement right out the window into the street, and the people who lived underground, under floor level, like in a basement and stuff like that, which was a lot of people, whenever it rained, it would wash all of that stuff into their homes. Disgusting. But that's what it was. You had the water in general got polluted very quickly. Disease became rampant. If there was a fire, what are these structures made out of? What are these buildings made out of? Wood. How do you get light? How do you get everything like that? With candle, with fire, everything. And if there's an accident, the whole place will go up immediately in flames. There's no fire escapes. There's no fire alarm. There's nothing like that. Extremely hazardous, extremely, and to alleviate the misery, men began to drink massively. Alcoholism was rampant, and with it came domestic abuse, rampant. You see, it was just a horrendous, horrendous situation. And let me give you an example that I always give. Little village in northern England called Newcastle, okay? In 1730, they had about 500 people living there. So in 1730, they had about 500 people. They built 10 or 12 factories there. And by 1765, the population was 85,000. So in 35 years, the population went from 500, which it had been for centuries, to 85,000. Imagine dealing with that if you are the mayor. Imagine trying to fix a problem like that. Now, before another principle of history is, before we say, oh, look at those people, can you believe they should have done something, they should have done that. Well, history is like a mirror reflecting back to us what we are, if we're willing to see what it is and accept what it is. And, you know, if we imagine, you know, Castro's gone, but Cuba, you know, communist Cuba suddenly collapses and we have 3 million refugees showing up in Miami tomorrow. How are we going to deal with that? You see these conditions all around the world, horrific poverty and squalor. How much do we really do about it? Now, I'm tempted to talk about Mountain Dew mouth right now, but I'm going to do that a little bit later. I'm going to come back to America, but first let me break this lecture in two. So here we go.